This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
You know, making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, and all the places.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features. I've directed Speed of Life and Bread and Butter. I'm making my third one now. It's called Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant, and I'm also a producer's rep, and I happened to work at Sundance at one point in my life.
Just happened to. This week, we welcome producer, actor Rhodes Fire and director, actor Ty Gordon on the show to talk about collaborating on their feature, Never Forgotten. After that, Liz is going to talk about her process in setting up the crowdfunding for her next feature, BFF. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
I'm okay. I received an email from my casting director today that was like, hey, just by the way, there's another supernatural horror comedy bachelorette party film script that's making the rounds right now. And I think it's called Batch Shit Crazy. And I can't find any info. It's a really good title, by the way. Like, it's way better title than our title. But I can't find any information on it. So that's the current drama, is like, is there like a little clone movie coming up the ranks just at the same time as us? Are we the Shark Tale to their Finding Nemo? What's going on? So that's what I'm dealing with right now. And I know it doesn't matter if they're the same script, because we've talked about this before. Like, it's our interpretation that matters, our unique voice. But still, not easy for casting purposes.
Right. Yeah. Who's going to raise money first? Who's going to get the cast first? Who's going to do the thing first? Who's going to make it happen? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny how those things can hurt and like feel like important in the moment, but then you realize it's actually not important at all. It doesn't matter.
Well, I can't even find them online, like, at all. I bet you can't really find us. Maybe you could find our Patreon campaign, but I just keep finding like bachelorette party pictures of girls in Scotland, like hen parties. So unless they're like really cool and really undercover, then maybe they're just really early in the process. What drama are you dealing with today with film?
I don't know. I guess it's kind of a weird thing to talk about, you know, because it's not like even close to me, really. But I watched The Fall Guy last night, which I don't know if you've heard all the drama about this movie and the whole thing, right, with this deal?
No.
That it's like highly rated movie, got like the best critic reviews, it's got the best audience rating, and then it like flopped at the box office. It made like $0.
I saw that like Twitter was talking about that, but like I don't. It's like they're not talking about international. They're not talking about ancillary. Like, I think these are just like buzzy headlines of people like, oh, box office. That's all there is to distribution. But please tell me. So you're worried about.
Well, no, it's just more like, so then they release it on Amazon Prime or to rent. They put on to rent like 2 weeks after, you know, it came out in theaters, and it's like still in theaters, I think. I watched it because that's the way I get to watch movies right now. And it was great. But it's a fucking awesome movie. It's a really cool movie. And, you know, you look at how hard they worked on the movie, and it's a movie about making movies, and it's a movie about like trying to like reach this certain level to a degree, you know, at the same time, which is, it's a movie that's like made for me. I like love this movie. But it just feels like, man, like these people like had made an incredible movie. They have movie stars. They do all the things. And then it's like not good enough for like, you know, the world. And it's like, man, like if that's not good enough, like what are we doing making independent movies? Like, what could we possibly do that's good enough of these people who have all the money and have the biggest movie stars? Like, if they're like not hitting whatever this mark needs to be, it's like, Jesus fucking Christ, like what else do you have to do, people? You know, so that was just a thought I had last night after watching this movie that I thought was really cool, you know, which you're right. It's still going to make its money back. I'm sure the play of putting it out for rent early is probably, you know, subsidizing the, you know, not doing great in movie theaters or whatever. And I'm less of a romantic, like, oh, my God, like movie theaters, if they die, we all die. It's like, you know, because I don't really think they're going to die. I think they're just going to, it's just going to change, you know, and I just think everyone watches movies in very many different ways, you know. But yeah, I don't know. I just feel like I'm feeling like there is this pressure on the whole industry right now, right? Like of like this, like the system is broken, like things aren't working, like no one's making any money. And so it just, and then there's all this noise about like these writers aren't like. Like, I see it on Twitter and Instagram all the time. People constantly sending me these things about, like, yeah, this writer can't make pay the bills. And they used to be, you know, doing just fine. And now, like, they can't get a writing job and blah, blah, blah. And after the strike, things are even worse and blee, blee, blee. And
we knew that would happen. Like, we knew the strike would make things worse. We all said that during the strike.
It just feels like what, like, you know, A is like, is everyone just whining, which I'm sure to a degree they are. And then two, it's like, what is the future of this world look like for us as making, in making movies? Like, what is it going to be like in 5 years, 10 years? I guess it's kind of impossible to know what it will be, you know, until we're there. But I guess all in all, it doesn't really matter. It's just like, you either make your movies or you don't make your movies.
Yeah, but, I'm still just hearing, like, I know that a lot of people earn really good money on bigger films like The Fall Guy, but and they deserve every single dollar that they get. But I still just think there's a lot of waste when it comes to larger budgeted films. And this feels like a really good time for a reckoning for things like that. Like, very silly. My husband works on a... I don't want to give it away. I don't want to get him in trouble, but he's working on a animated television show that's going to premiere on Amazon Prime. And it's from pretty well-known actors and studios. And they had like a wrap party. And that's like very normal to have a wrap party. But if you think about it, like, why are they having a wrap party? Like, between venue reservations, catering, like gift bags, like... all of these things that they had to get in line, but that money is not going to a recoupment of a budget ever. It's just a party. And I feel like most people are not having a great time at that party. They're going because they feel obligated to go for work to see their bosses and to be like, I'm here for you. I came to the party. This is how I see life. Is this very cold?
Oh my God.
This is a cold way to see life. Yeah. I
don't know. I guess it's different too. I mean, I've been to one or two big rap parties on bigger movies and they were fucking fun, you know, because when they have more money, it's like they just fucking give you shit, like free bar. Hella badass food, you know, whatever. And like, you get to have a good time. But I've also been to ones where it's like, it's just us and like, you know, a few cases of beer and some wine and some booze. And it's just the crew together. And that's also really fun. So yeah, I don't know. But I guess I don't go to the parties where like the executives are that you need to like impress. So I don't know. Maybe it's
different. This is a pretty low key party, but I still think it's a waste of money. I still think like film sets of a certain ilk are bloated. And this, like, I know that's not the main reason why people aren't making money and why budgets aren't being recouped. But we have to like look at these things, right? Like the ridiculousness, the pomp and circumstance of the film industry. That's not why we should be making these movies. We should make these movies. We should tighten our belts and we should make them the best way we can with the least amount of money we can, if we can do that.
Like, where do you stand on set gifts? Are you like, do you get little gift bags and gifts for your actors and stuff like that?
And my producer gave me a gift on my last shoot and it was very nice of them. But I still am like, why did they spend my money to get me a gift? Because it was like 75% funded through my efforts. Like, I just kind of felt like we could have been paying a crew member a little bit more than you getting me like a Van Halen record, which was, again, very nice because I very much like Van Halen. But I still think there's a better way to approach spending money.
Do you think that producer used your money to buy you a gift? You don't think they just like used their own money to do that?
I think they used our budget to.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know for sure. I would think that they would use our budget.
So cynical.
I don't think that they should be using their own money either. I think they should just not. I also don't. Look, I'm a soulless human being. I'm really bad with presents. I'm really bad with sentimentality. This is a family trait. But I just think we need to be more economic. That's all.
Well, I'm more for cutting the foo-foo gifts that no one gives a shit about, like that, yeah. Like are in your green room or whatever, or like your hotel when you come to the movie set or whatever. Like that stuff, I think, is more like no one needs that ego stroking, right? I mean, people probably like it, but whatever. But I think the crew likes a party. Do you have parties at the end of your movies, or you don't do parties?
We've done a party for each movie, and I think they're stupid. I just am there feeling obligated to be there because I'm paid for the party.
You don't chat with the crew and the actors and have a good time and rewind, relax. And
you know, I would have way more fun going to someone's like backyard with a red Solo cup with like Jack Daniels and a cube of ice. I would just have so much more fun there than going to this other thing. I guess so. I'm just saying, like, it doesn't have to be fancy schmancy. Like, we were all going through war together. Why do we have to put on nylons? I don't know. I just don't get it. I don't get it at all.
Yeah. Well, I try to do rap parties, even if it's just like taking the crew out for beers at the end of a shoot or whatever. Like, yeah. You know, there's always something. But yeah, we definitely don't do fancy rap parties on my indie movies. There's no dressing up or anything. Although I have been to those on movie sets where it's like, you know, like crewing up a movie is like it is a big party. It is a big thing. And we do all get dressed up or whatever, you know, best to our ability. But yeah, I also have missed them. I missed one at Rita Moreno's house, which was like, aww. I really was supposed to be amazing. I just couldn't go because
I guess that's a good story. Stuff. Like I went to Rita Moreno's house and we did, you know, but again, it's silly.
Yeah,
it's fun, but it's silly.
I'm pro party, anti gifts. But, you know, also I realize that that's part of the thing that you have to do. Yeah. And it's like, that's why I have a producer to be like, okay, let's not offend anybody. Let's make sure to get whatever shit gift, you know, they need in order for it to feel like they're welcomed and loved, you know, and that they're not like
just bull, write a nice you know? Thank you note to everyone. Each person gets a thank you note. You don't get a party. Thank you note actually expresses genuine emotion, how you feel about them, how grateful for you are for them. Done. It's worth way more than a party, a thank you note, or genuine thank you note.
Yeah.
Bring back thank you notes.
Bring back thank you notes. Kill all parties and fun. Liz Manischel's number one rule.
Kind of.
What you shouldn't kill is going to our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. This is where the show can continue to live, to thrive, to grow, to get bigger, have better guests, more fun, live shows again at some point, maybe. But a big happy birthday to Ryan Thomas for supporting the show. If you don't recognize that name, Ryan Thomas was a previous guest. He's a wonderful DP, and I'm sure he would love it if everyone checked out his website, RyanThomasDP.com. You can also give him a follow at RD Thomas on Instagram. He looks like he just did a really badass spot for Jack in a Box. So that's cool. Pretty sweet. But yeah, Ryan, thank you so much for supporting the show and for still listening after all these years. Really appreciate it. Also, you can leave us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts as it is now. Ratings and reviews are really, really helpful. Do that if you will. Without any further delay, here's our chat with Rhodes Fire and Ty Gordon. Well, Ty and Rhodes, welcome to the show. Can you, either together or one and then the other, give us the elevator pitch for Never Forgotten?
All you, Ty. 3-minute elevator pitch. No one had ever seen it. It's always so interesting because Ty, I think, wore almost every hat on this project. But as far as like the log line goes, you have three friends who grew up in this small coastal town, and it's the eve of their high school reunion, and you realize that these friends are losing their shit. Because there's a secret that's either going to destroy them personally or tear them apart or destroy the town.
Also, can you each just ID yourself and all the roles you played on the film?
Yeah, go for it, Ty.
I was the star, of course. I directed, wrote, produced, among others, and executive produced.
I was the producer. I also, because we worked in a very micro budget, the entire film, I think, came in a little under 300,000, set during the pandemic, which of course, 25% of that was COVID budget. I produced, I helped with costume design, I had to jump into one role because we had a negative testing. like basically everything that Ty wasn't doing, I was doing.
Yeah. And Robert helped out in a big way too. He kind of filled the voids where you and I needed it, you know?
Yeah. Robert is one of the executives over at Wooden Finger Studios. So the evolution of this project was, you know, obviously we're at the height of the pandemic, our first time we get shut down, and it's a little crazy. We had a positive COVID test from the makeup artist, and it was something we couldn't control. She lived outside of LA, so she had to go get tested. She was the only person that we had actually tested, their private physician, and our private physician had COVID. So it was just like when she tested positive, you know, we had the blue light team come in. But during that time, Wooden Finger Studios, which is a group of creatives, Ty Gordon, Robert Preston, and Andrew John Tevis, who worked together, had said, hey, we want to make a movie. And I was introduced to them by Lauren Selman. And she herself is a producer and said, you know, hey, I think I know somebody who's already made a couple of shorts during the pandemic. She can kind of take the lead here for a feature. And that's what I did twice.
Wow. Amazing. So how many days did you end up shooting in the end for the movie?
It was 12 days, right?
Wow.
12 days with you as a principal. We ended up having about 20 days.
Oh, wow.
We broke it down in kind of little segments early on. And Ty, you're probably missing this one, is when we did some exterior footage with Ty that we didn't necessarily need sound. And then we went into cast heavy and location heavy. Because how many locations did we have, Ty?
We definitely had quite a few, I would say.
We shot in three different counties. So then the bulk of it was the 12 days consecutively. We had one day off. That was Santa Barbara, LA, Orange County. Yeah, Santa Barbara, LA.
We're kind of all over Southern California.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the origin of the idea? Is this a personal story for you, Ty? Were you inspired by something that happened to you, or it just came out of your imagination?
Well, it started with a nightmare. Me and my neighbor friend, it was like kind of like the younger version of me. So it was interesting because it was similar in that way. But like me and my neighbor friend, somebody accidentally died and it was like somehow our fault. And so like, we're like, oh shit, what do we do? You know? And so we like buried him. And I woke up and I was like, man, that's like such a harrowing and just bad dream. But, you know, I was like, it just feels like it's got a story written all over it, you know? And I started just conceiving of this story. We were working on a different film, actually, me, Robert, and Andrew. We were working on a different film. We decided that we wanted to take a trip to Big Bear and rent out a cabin. And when we got there, I was actually right before we got there, I said, you know what, you guys, I have this idea for this smaller budget indie film, and I think it would really like kickstart us as a company. It would really like just bolster our image within the industry. And so sure enough, we were there in Big Bear in the cabin, and we were just spitballing ideas, brainstorming away. And so that's kind of how the story came about.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Westwood One.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
And then how long did you spend, like, when this happened, when you had this nightmare, like, you know, how long did it take from the original inception of the idea to, like, the movie being completed and released?
6 years.
Wow.
For what it's worth, my latest film was inspired by a nightmare in 2020, and we're shooting it in 2024, so we will probably release in 2026. So we're on the same timeline. We like to ask if you could change, if both of you could change anything about the film. It could be about something you did, something you witnessed, something in the script, an experience you have. What would it be?
Obviously, when you're working with a micro budget and you're wearing a lot of hats, it can be incredibly stressful. Jack of all trades, master of none. But it allows for us to cut back on not only the number of cast, but the number of people on the payroll, right? So unfortunately, during this time in COVID, we had one actor actually violate the COVID policy. We had done some deep research into what Jurassic Park was filming at the time. We got their COVID policy. We had done some really deep research, making sure I like to lead my productions with safety. I'm really into Charles Duhigg. And for me, not only is, you know, the production an experience of a lifetime, but I also think that we're all very much humans and I take on the responsibility of everyone's safety. So we had everybody go through the COVID, the quarantine, and then we were about 3 days out from shooting this particular actress, and another actress approached me and showed me a video. And it was 2 days prior. It was date stamped on Instagram. And she was partying and sharing the same shot glass as everybody else. And, you know, you have a group of 30 sharing one glass, and it's obviously COVID. Everybody's very frightened. Everybody's going through it. So I had to go from taking and wearing this producer hat to kind of wearing this disciplinary function. And it was so not fun. It was not received well. We had to immediately recast, and we had to make sure that whoever we were recasting, so we had to re-audition. This was a speaking part. We had to make sure that they had been quarantined. We had to go in to do 3 days of testing in a row. So it was really, really a fire. But in addition to that, this talent's reaction to it was kind of heartbreaking. I think sometimes you just accept and hope that people are like, yeah, my bad. You know, I'm so sorry. And instead it was a complete verbal attack, aggressive attack that lasted for almost a year afterwards. So if I had to redo it all, I think I would have just, I know I said, I started this by saying I lead with safety, but I would have gone back and told everybody my why, you know? So yeah. How about you, Ty?
Anything I would have done differently. The script went through a lot of revisions, and there were some lines in there that made it into the final cut that wasn't as I envisioned it. But I kind of say that with a grain of salt, because anytime you're making a movie, kind of takes on a life of its own. Kind of the overarching sense I got, I remember just riding high on life after our Hollywood premiere. I was telling the guys and my girlfriend at the time, now wife, that, you know, everything turned out perfect. No movie is like without mistakes. This was after our family premiere in Arizona. My parents live in Arizona, so we did a family premiere in Arizona. And I remember after everyone watched the movie, my dad said, Ty, I mean, that was a really great movie. He said, that was a lot better than I thought it would be. And he didn't really have any like point of context.
Right.
Given, like, as Rhodes has been saying, like a smaller budget film just kind of has the feelings of a larger budget than it was. There are a few lines, a few things in the script that I was at first kind of like bummed about that made it into the final cut. But afterwards, I was like, you know what? I love it as a whole. And that's really the main thing.
Nice. So this is kind of for both, but mostly aimed at Rhodes. You know, everybody wants a producer for their movie. Everybody wants to have somebody come in and like run the ship for them or like be that partner, you know, but it's really hard to find. So can you just talk a little bit about like, A, how you found this project, and then B, why did you say yes to this one over other projects that you could have said yes to?
Oh, Ty, you'll remember this. So my production company, Unpaved Roads, is a for-hire production company. it's the only way that we can do our own internal passion pieces as well. But, and I know Liz from school, story is king. And when you take a story that you're like, okay, I can see, for me, I'm really critical on, is there a plot and is there a protagonist that's constantly moving this story forward? Okay, great. As long as the story's got the key point, then it's time to meet with the team. And this is where I said Ty will know, is because I was like, hey guys, I know we're in the middle of a pandemic and we've done like 5 Zoom calls, but now it's time to meet in person. And now it's time to have like a creative jam session so I can understand what your heart is before we enter into. I'm really a stickler for sign the deal memos. Let's get stuff down in ink that lays out the parameters of expectations. And, you know, I have to make sure, I think that there are a lot of creatives out there who dream about the production process, and the production process and the even pre-production is so much fun. It's really, really, I feel like the glamorous part of it, aside from the premiere, but it's post, and it's that dedication to review your project 1,000 times. And when I met with them in person, not only did I get to meet 3 young men who were incredibly excited about their project, but from their short work, and Robert, who's on his team, had already had a film that Ty had EP'd, a feature film, Obscura. So he understood, like, yeah, I get it. I hear what you're saying. This is about the follow through. I understand this is going to be hard. No matter what, we're going to finish this project and put it out into the world. So that for me was, okay, great. Let's do this. And we had a couple of other producers who were attached at the time. You know, I'm sure we all remember the pandemic when, you know, somebody would get sick or somebody would get COVID. And all of a sudden they were like, hey, I don't want to be a part of anything. I don't want to leave my house. So we had a couple of producers step out, but like I had said, Lauren Selman, who she's actually on the Academy team. She helps produce and run some of the behind the scenes for the Oscars. She had known a neighbor of Robert's growing up, and they said, hey, we thought of you. Would you be interested in this? And of course, Lauren was the one who so kindly said, I'm not, but because I don't have the bandwidth right now. Oscars is taking everything virtually, but I do believe I know somebody. And then, of course, I went through the process with them. And anybody who can go through the process with me deserves a brownie patch, because I am just very naturally a passionate, intense person. My father was a drill sergeant. I don't pick up the ball unless I'm going to take it to the goal.
I wanted to ask a little bit about the speed with which you made this production and then the turnaround in working together again almost immediately on the next project. So you're talking about commitment, you're talking about follow through, you're talking about high energy individuals. Was that, what were the pieces that allowed you to work so quickly and efficiently as a team?
I think actually your question kind of answered it. The fact that we had worked together in the midst, in the heart of COVID, had a shutdown. We had our playbook, like, you know, our Bible, our show Bible. So I start with pre-production. I build out the base camp, both virtually. My business partners, Rachel Glago and Mikkel Buchanan, are very, very strong partners and collaborators. So we have this fluid language of passing the baton. And now, having worked with Wooden Finger Studios in one production, we were able to say, okay, we've got the template. We've got all the modifications to the template. Now let's do it again. Energy begets energy, right? So I always feel that my number one thing when working with individuals, and I'll give a huge shout out to our crew, which a lot of them were AFI alums, but it was this sense of urgency. You know, it's this, hey, you now have this film school understanding, which I do believe, Liz, you can attest to this, but USC was like, fire, get the screenplay done, get the film done. Like, you were just constantly in it. So we have this education of understanding the sense of urgency, but now we're doing it in real time. So I'm incredibly impressed with what the Wooden Finger Studio team did with post and how quickly they turned it around. And that enabled us, Ty and I had a conversation where Ty was like, you know, hey, I loved working with you guys. Let's do it again. And he came in on an executive producer for my passion project and my directorial debut. And I believe we're going to do it again and again and again. So, you know, it's just when you've got the team, when you've got the crew that you work with and you work well with, it's almost like you speak your own language.
So the thing that everybody wants to know about, because that's the most difficult part for most people to do, is how did you raise the money? So $300,000, that's like a pretty hefty price tag. I know it's a low budget movie, but that's a lot of money to raise. So can you guys talk about how that money came together and how you were able to make it happen?
Ty has, he has done several shorts and, you know, he has independent financing. So he is able to fund this through a company that he built relationships with when he was in film school. And then that company has entered into what I believe, and Ty, you can correct me, a 3-picture deal with him. So it's relationships. Ty, you want to add anything?
It's kind of who you know. We have a lot of generous people in our lives who not only wanted to be a part of this, but wanted to see this dream of all of us come to fruition, come to full life. We have a really strong team, Wooden Finger Studios. And then as Rhodes mentioned, we've partnered pretty closely with Unpaved Roads, Rhodes' company. And so I think that what it starts with is the passion that comes out in your voice when you speak of a project, when you really feel connected to the artistic side of it. And then you get into the nitty gritty of, you know, kind of like, how is this going to yield us a profit ultimately? And I know Robert is very much in that arena. I know Rhodes is proficient with that too. I tend to focus more on the artistic stuff, but I do chime in on the business stuff as well. Everybody involved, everybody like in the whole pool of this financing wanted to see this movie made. And so it kind of happened that way.
I also think, Alric, that and I know that Ty's project, so we followed it up with the next film that we did, again, 300K. I think that there's a couple of things that should be said. Is one, it's a little bit of piecemeal. And when you get the first amount, it's a lot easier to get the second amount. Mm-hmm. Two, you have to be a tenacious salesperson. I'm not saying I like that at all, but understanding who I'm speaking with and understanding what the ask is. We partnered with Miranda Bailey's company, Film Arcade, for distribution. And it was, you know, hey, we do need a publicist to walk us through social media. We do have part of this, but, you know, a lot of that again is us doing the research, supporting it with the work. And then I think the most important part of the equation, which is why I think the meeting with the Wooden Finger Studios team was vital, is the proof is in the pudding. So, you know, Ty had several short projects, but with regards to my resume, I had been working on shorts and features and jumping in from AD to producer to line producer and really having a really strong understanding and being able to say, I think, Ty, what was our original budget for this project when we partnered for Never Forgotten?
Yeah, it was 75K and it grew substantially.
And like I said, 25% was dedicated to COVID, but then even trying to keep it in an amount where we could control the profit and loss as much as you can with a movie, you know, in the afterwards process, we were really blessed.
I want to ask Ty a little bit about what drives you, Ty. I mean, I think about examples in film history of writer, director, actors. And I always want to get under the hood of what's that kernel, what's that spark that pushes that individual forward to really manifest that project. I mean, I know we know the origin of the idea, but was there something that you can attribute your ambition on this project?
Yeah, I would definitely consider myself a dreamer. Had a lot of dreams as a kid, but the one thing that always stuck, the one mainstay, was actor-filmmaker. So it was almost like I just had this kind of embedded in my heart or in my soul, if you will, to do this one day. And it was very serendipitous and fateful that I reconnected with Robert here. And then I met Rhodes and her team. As far as you bringing up like the multiple hats, funny enough, I remember going to the theaters in 2017 and seeing The Disaster Artist. You guys may have seen it. So, I mean, that wasn't like the greatest example of someone who wore multiple hats, but I was like, man, if he can do it, why can't I do it? Like, what's holding me back, you know?
I love that, and actually. So, I thought you were going to say like Kevin Costner or Clint Eastwood. I like that you're bringing
it
in.
I know, right? Well, yeah. You know, props to those guys too, because there are definitely some like people who came before me who did a tremendous job carrying multiple torches, so to speak. For me, though, when it really came down to like right before we were going to like enter into principal, and like, I would say even before pre-production, I wanted to have creative control, but I didn't want to hold on too tightly to that, because I felt like with all these creative minds combined, it was kind of like this really great like potpourri of just creative insight. And so, you know, really as a director, I wanted to create a unified vision. And that's what I've said in previous interviews is like, you know, because as an actor, as a producer, as an executive, as a director and stuff, you know, you definitely have to offload some of your duties at times. And Robert and Rhodes did a tremendous job helping me with that. I have to say they're definitely more technical than I am. I'm as I characterize it, I'm an introverted performance director, and Robert is an extroverted technical director. And I would say Rhodes is very privy to those technicalities as well, as she showed on set. And so, you know, for a long time, I thought I would do that for every one of my films, but just kind of a recent development, I decided that, you know, I wanted to kind of relinquish some of those roles and really focus on just acting and EPing primarily. So that's where I'm at currently in my career. And I'm really excited for things to go forward, because I got a lot of talented people to fill those voids.
Can you guys talk a little bit about the distribution for the film, like how that was secured and how that came about? I know you mentioned it a little bit, but like, was that something that was sort of baked into your relationships with the production companies you worked with? Or is that something that kind of came afterwards once the movie was completed?
It came afterwards once the movie was completed. There was a lot of ambiguity during the pandemic. I don't think anybody knew what was going to happen, who was going to buy what, why they were buying it. And so I ran point on distribution. What was really interesting is simply by posting it on IMDb and kind of putting it out there as like, hey, this project exists. I became very, very aware that it was going, oh gosh, I'm trying to sugarcoat this, Alric. Man, you talk about the sharks come out. You know, when you drop a movie and you put it out there.
Oh, do you mean the barnacles? Do you mean the scum-sucking sales agents who come out of the woodwork?
But I've been in entertainment since I started as a child actor. So
you've
you know,
seen the worst of the worst. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I would have one company reach out to me, and then I would throw it to my trusted network. You know, hey, have you guys heard of this? I'm researching this person, and it said on IMDb Pro that he's connected to you, or I see he's your Facebook friend. And I would get the like, yeah, don't do any business with this guy whatsoever. Or yeah, I had a deal. You know, I have to give a huge shout to Slated and my buddy Jay Burnley over there, because we partnered with them in the sense that we were looking for distribution, and they have a model of which they'll introduce you to different companies. And he was able to really say, you know, hey, I've got this project with this distribution company, and I've got this project. Do you want to talk to their producers? You know, and kind of as Liz knows, or, you know, you make this list of people like, yeah, I went with this company and I don't have any reports. I don't have any post reports. I've had no payment. Or I went with this company and supposedly we made this much, but now I'm chasing them for payment. So it became this list of elimination. And while we were doing that, more and more time was passing, beginning to look at different territories. Ty was very, very specific in wanting to have a worldwide distribution, but also wanting to be able to share it with his friends and family and kind of move on to his next project very quickly. And that was when we had partnered I called Miranda Bailey. Miranda had started one of my short films. She's a very talented actress as well as a producer and director. And I called her and said, hey, here's what I've got. I've got these companies. They're looking for, and I'll kind of digress a little bit. They're looking for anywhere. I think our base offers were 15K for marketing budget. And I think our highest was 80K. So meaning that a company came out and said, hey,
oh my gosh,
we're going to get, yes, we're going to, your marketing expense budget is 80K and we're doing this for Europe and we're going to do this for this market and this is going to be domestic. And so I broke it down with Miranda. And then she asked me as the season producer she is, she said, well, what does Ty want? And I said, Ty just, he wants it out there. You know, he wants it out there. He wants it available to everybody. And she said, all right, well, why don't we just go? I mean, if he's not tied to, which some people are, the film festival circuit, if he's not passionate about, you know, an SVOD kind of grabbing it and saying, hey, we've got this, let's just put it out there. And that's what Film Arcade did with regards to distribution. They connected us directly with BitMax, and I have nothing but raves about BitMax. BitMax put us through the process of how it would go with every, I always get them, help me out, Liz, SVOD, AVOD, TVOD.
Window of distribution. Window? Do you want to say window?
Yeah, well, yeah, basically, of how it was going to go, what our deliverables was, what's quality control was, and then, yeah, I like Ty said, I'm able to speak tech a pretty well. So Andrew and I just went through, Andrew and his team, we went through back and forth. I think the only thing we didn't do was have it translated into different languages. But other than that, we just went direct. And then Ty was able to have a kind of like virtual, we were coming out of the pandemic and Ty was able to have this virtual kind of, hey, the movie's out there, please buy it, please see it, you know, please rate it, please share it, pretty immediate. So we had an entire year. We went into production November 2021. We got shut down. We were back into production January 2022. And we had the release party, I believe, November 2022.
Mm-hmm. This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I am a part of the team for Farewelling, the second collaboration. And so I was curious, what lessons are you taking into the release? And what lessons did you take into the production and pre-production development from Never Forgotten to Farewelling?
The first lesson is that I don't want to do distribution ever again. No, so that's why we brought on Liz. But some of the lessons from pre-production. Ty, you want to take a swing at this one? How we're taking pre-production and then what we're doing with Farewelling? I think, you know, you wore all the hats for Never Forgotten, but then in Farewelling, you came in as an EP. How are those two things different?
As you might imagine, your amount of involvement, specifically during principal, different EPs have a different idea about that. You know, they might want to be really on top of things and, you know, make sure that where their money's going, they're getting, you know, what they want within the filtration system, I'll say, of all the other creative minds and all the other executives. But when Rhodes approached me to EP Farewelling, she had pretty much, I mean, she had already proven herself as a creative and technical mind to me. And there wasn't really any hesitation for me to do that. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Rhodes, but I believe it was like gap funding. It was like the last little bit you needed to really kind of get this plane off the ground, so to speak. And, you know, I just thought the whole concept was interesting from reading the script to just all those pre-production stuff that I had been hearing about. And sure enough, you know, when we had our Hollywood premiere of Farewelling, I just remember like going into it being like, even though like I was more hands off with this one, I remember watching the movie and just loving every minute of it, just being like, my assessment of Rhodes's talent and creative chops as a filmmaker was definitely accurate, because, you know, I just I tell her sometimes, you know, I can't wait to watch it. You know, I know it's going through this festival circuit and has been for a while, which is really exciting. But I think it's just that chain link of trust, as I like to call it, and the chain link of proving grounds, I'll say, because once somebody proves themselves to me on one project, you know, it's like I'm eager to help out in any way that I can on subsequent projects.
That's amazing.
I also think, you know, it's really exciting. We live during a time where the answer to this question is unknown. I mean, how many times can the entertainment industry shut down? So we went from Never Forgotten and the pandemic, and then we went into Farewelling and we did the SAG strike and the WGA strike. When there's uncertainty in the industry, every production, regardless of the stage that it's in, halts in some way or has to pivot. So, you know, our expectations for pre-production and now the reality in the distribution and this part of the post-production is it has to be fluid. You know, I think it was really interesting. Genres do matter. And when I speak to filmmakers who are really passionate about their projects, there is that reality conversation where it's like, look, I've worked very intimately with a lot of, you know, I've had two bosses in the entertainment industry who have been Variety's top 100 executives. And so it's not that the project isn't beautiful or doesn't have an amazing team, but there's a point in the process where it becomes analytics and it becomes numbers. And that is directly correlated to genre. Farewelling is kind of like this art house film. And I thank you, Ty, for all the compliments on it. But I wanted to make something female driven. I wanted to make something that was, there was the story of women coming out of that Me Too movement, but also not being able to necessarily handle it all. And that's what I was really passionate about. I knew that my trajectory was film festivals. Now, did I know I was going to spend so much on film festival fees? No. No, I did not. I also did not know that many of them were going to go virtual again. But you have to have some fluidity and the ability to pivot when you're going into post, because the truth is that the world is different. Circumstances are different. And, you know, Ty was talking about 6 years to make Never Forgotten. I don't think in his inception phase could he ever imagine the limitations that we had to face because the whole world shut down. Yeah. Because this location, you know, which was 40% of our scenes, their store owner got COVID and we lost the location, you know, a week before we were going into production. So it was wild. It's wild. Fluidity.
So I think it's time for our last six questions. These are like bigger picture questions, but let's try to get through them pretty quickly, especially since there's two of you to answer independently. So whoever wants to go first can go first. But the first question is, what's the first film you made and how do you feel about it now? And this could be anything, like something you made when you were a kid, your first, you know, high school movie, whatever it is.
The first short that I made was 10 years ago. I was 23 going on 24. I spent I didn't go to film school, but I took some film classes and I made this really neat short film. And it was interesting because part of like my realization as a creative was like, I saw the whole thing play out in my mind's eye before I even like started doing, and I did the editing, I did everything for it, but I saw the whole thing. And as soon as like the prompt was given to us, I was like, I know exactly what I'm going to do. And that's exactly what I did. And so that was about 10 years ago.
I was 10. And I just finished Little Women. And so I wrote an adaptation that I casted all of my cousins in and forced all of our parents to watch. And it took me more than 20 years to figure out I wanted to be a writer-director after that. But I've done it several times in my life.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Filmmaking advice wasn't firsthand advice, but something I stumbled across with Quentin Tarantino, where he said, and this is before I had done like a major, any feature type movies. But he said, you know, you don't have to know everything. You don't even have to know what the 180 line is, you know, but if you're the most passionate person on set about your story, people will follow you and people will help you make a great movie. And That brought me great relief.
Mine was, and I share this on my TikTok account, I can't remember who said it, but it has made the biggest impact with regards to filmmaking. But it's kind of like this derivative of Winston Churchill's never, never give up. But it's like, don't give up before the payoff. You know, you never know how close you are to it. And I think that in every project, and I've had some not so great projects, sometimes the payoff is what I learned.
And conversely, what's the worst filmmaking advice you've both ever received?
Oh, I'm going to jump in here.
Yeah.
I actually really liked this professor at USC. He was a guest professor who, this was before the Me Too movement. And he said, I am a strong woman. The one thing they always teach, they always tell you is write what you know. And this particular individual said to me, I said, hey, I write strong women leads, female leads. And he said, plan to go into indie filmmaking and never make any money because female leads don't pay. It was the worst and probably also kind of the best because it lit this fire that was like, how do I get better at writing female leads, you know? But yeah, I've never forgotten that.
So my answer to that, Ulrich, would be it wasn't advice per se, but it was something I read in a pretty famous screenwriting book that some of you may have read. It's called Save the Cat. I really enjoyed this book when I was reading it, but it was interesting, you know, Blake Snyder, the author, rest his soul, you know, he was just like saying, like, your script should be 110 pages, end of story, nowhere for discussion. I learned a lot of great things from reading that book, but one thing I wanted to not fall trapped to was just making my films formulaic and predictable and cliched, you know? So I think that so far I've avoided those pitfalls and plan to continue to do so.
Last question for both of you. Is making movies hard?
I would say if you have enough passion, you have a unified vision with a lot of talented actors and filmmakers, it doesn't really feel like work, and thus it doesn't really feel hard per se. But I would say the hardest time I had on set of Never Forgotten was just working with my acting coach in the Sprinter van that we rented, and just being like, I really want to bring the best to my character. I mean, he's the lead character. It demands that of me. Funny enough, that was probably the most difficult part, but it was also my favorite part. It's kind of a hybrid option, but mostly the overriding factor would be if you have enough passion and love for it, it doesn't really feel that difficult because you just kind of get in a flow with everyone and the story and stuff.
It's funny because I was on my way to law school before I did a pivot and decided to go to film school. There are quite often a lot of times that I daydream about being a lawyer in the middle of any process of the production. Yeah, it's really, really hard. It takes a village to make a movie. It takes incredibly amazing, incredible, hardworking, like-minded, collaborative individuals to get every aspect of filmmaking done. So is it hard? Yeah. Is it worth it? Yes. You know, you have the voice and you have the ability to storytell on a level that can change people's lives. But I'm also an athlete, and I've been an athlete my whole life. And I am just as exhausted after a 14-hour day on set as I am doing a triathlon. So yeah. Yes, it's
Liz, what do you remember about our talk with Rhodes and Ty?
Just that they're both lovely human beings. Rhodes is actually a client of mine for her feature that she did after Never Forgotten called Farewelling. And we just found a distributor for her. And it was just amazing to work with her and her team. Yeah. So I like the way she works, I like the way she looks at the world. And Ty was just a lovely human that we got to get to know when we did the podcast. What do you remember?
I like the way that they collaborated together, you know, and the way that they, it was fun to hear like the way they broke up the director and the producer duties on the project, which, I mean, obviously we all know, but it's fun just to hear kind of the way that people work together. It was also cool that like they ended up collaborating on another movie. Like I think Ty has something to do with Farewelling. I'm not sure if that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're collaborating on multiple projects.
Yeah, but it's just fun to like see like a group come together and make one movie and then make another movie and then make more movies and stuff. And so that I really enjoyed that part of the conversation.
Yay.
So Liz, it is time. I cannot wait to hear all about this. You've been talking about your new film, Best Friends Forever, for 1,000,000,000 years, and you're finally getting your crowdfunding going. You have dates, I think, set for crowdfunding. So I want to hear all the deals, man. The deals. I want to hear all the details. I want to know how much you're going for, why you decided to do crowdfunding, and how you're planning and setting this whole thing up.
Well, we're shooting our Kickstarter video on Thursday. So today is May 28th. Thursday is 2 days from now, the 30th. I wrote the script. We're on draft 3 of the Kickstarter script. I just bought all of the props last night. Eric Toms is going to be in the video as the killer of the film industry. We have a masked man who plays a murderer of the film industry. I'm really looking forward to working with him. My husband plays essentially the film industry, and he gets murdered over and over again. I don't know if anyone has noticed a trend, but I like to put my husband in situations where he gets maimed in some way in the movies that I make. But I did give him a love scene in Speed of Life, so I'm just offsetting the good gifts I've given him. But we're probably basing our target raise off of what we think we can raise, not off of what we need. Because, you know, what you need is kind of an absurd number in indie film. It's like, what you need, what is the kitchen sink version of the film? What's the next tier down? What's the next tier down? But I'm thinking we'll probably put the raise at about 25, which will be very hard to do. 25,000, very hard to do, but meaningful amount. And we're building up the incentives right now and getting ready to launch. Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. So do you feel like 25 is like a high number on the world of numbers?
Yeah.
You see people raising like 40,000, 50,000, 60,000. So like when I set for 25, I think I got 22, which was like right inside the zone that I need to be for Seed and Spark to like actually get my money. But why do you think 25 is such a hard ask for a crowdfunding campaign?
Well, you know, I used to be a crowdfunding consultant, and 25 was like what you could, it was like the barrier of what you could raise if you weren't like an influencer, essentially. Like it's like a normal human who is regularly or not regularly, but who is often regularly on social media. Maybe they have some sort of email newsletter, but they're not a celebrity, but they're just going to work their damnedest. 25 seems to be like on the outer limits of what you can do. And we need way more than 25, right? So that's why we said 25, because it seemed like the best we could do, considering donor fatigue, considering the fact this is my third crowdfunding campaign, my third through Kickstarter as well. You know, there's like a lot of variables. And the reason we're doing a crowdfunding campaign in addition to raising funds that we need is because I do truly believe it creates a level of momentum. It helps manifest the project. It creates a little bit of energy towards the project. It's a marketing effort. Like there's a lot of things that builds goodwill between you and your audience. If you're giving like good rewards and communicating well and expressing gratitude. So it's a way to launch our film into the world. And that's how I'm seeing it.
That's awesome. Yeah. I feel like the launching part is really important, but yeah, I don't know. It's always tricky with these because you have to strike the right balance, you know? Talking about rewards, what are you guys doing for rewards? Are you doing the all digital approach that you've talked about in the past? And like, where are you going with numbers? Are you going like, do you have a 10, a 15, a 20, or do you go like 5 to 25? Like where are you setting your numbers at?
The goal with crowdfunding is always give a reward that's worth more than what people are paying for it. Right. So we're going to be, I think we may be doing some physical rewards. Like I might be doing some like friendship bracelets because it's about best friends and a reunion and childhood friendship. And there might be some things related to s'mores, and there might be some fortune tellers and some mass sheets. These are all like very femme-centric coming of age things. But what I like to do is digital sentimental rewards. So in other previous campaigns, I did, like I mentioned earlier, I did like a one-page cheerleading note to someone who paid, I think they paid like $15 or $30. But it was like me being like, here's why I love you. Here's why you're great. Here's why you could do anything. And it's very specific to them, but it's just meant to cheer them up and remind them that they're wonderful and they're valued. So it's like very sentimental. Like, I don't do this bullshit like you have to pay me for me to follow you on social media, or you have to pay me for me to shout you out on social media. It's like the shout out on social media only benefits us and our campaign. So that's silly. But it's all about giving people more than we get to create a level of camaraderie between us. So I've also done like mixtapes, like Spotify playlists. What else? What have I done? Like really bad pet doodles before. Like, they're all things that involve my labor.
And you don't post those to social. That's all just directly to the person.
I'll post it on social. What I'm saying is, like, I can't stand when campaigns are like, give us $10 and we'll shout you out on Twitter. It's like, we're not famous. We don't have gazillions of followers. Like, how, why should anyone pay me to shout them out on social media? No, everything is in public. Thank yous are in public. Shout outs are in public. Pet doodles, you know.
Yeah, because you're still doing, because that is what makes sense, right? Is that you would do something that would go on your social to like get awareness for the movie and also give this person something at the same time. Yeah. So yeah, that makes sense to me for sure. But yeah, I like that you're giving something that's more value than just a shout out, than just a thank you. That's like a thank you plus it's like, oh, here's a cool little thing.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is to be approachable and warm and grateful. And I also, like, I've given to a few campaigns the past couple years, and it's like, I'm always very surprised at how a lot of campaigns have no personality. You know, they'll just be like, thank you for giving to my campaign. And it's okay. All right.
But well, I think the thing,
go on. What were you saying?
I was just saying, if you do it yourself, it's like, that's what really matters. You know, if like you're the one who is writing all the responses, you know, even if like you do end up saying some of the same things over and over, but like if it's coming from you personally, I think that's what makes a big difference, you know.
I don't know. I want enthusiasm. Like, I want to know that what I did as a donor meant something to the person overseeing the campaign. And I think a lot of people give to get a little boost to their day and feel like they did something really good for someone else. I mean, that's why I give. And so when someone doesn't thank me, or they thank me in a very personality-less way, I don't get that high of like, I was a little small superhero for the day, right? So I think my goal for the campaign is just to make everyone feel like they're a superhero for being a part of our movie, because I really want to make this movie.
What are some of the things you're doing as far as setting yourself some goals? Like, do you have people lined up to support the crowdfunding campaign in advance, or are you're just going into it without that?
No, I mean, I'm just talking about it a lot. So like, I've already mentioned it quite a lot on social media. I'm going to mention it in my newsletter. I talk about it on the podcast. The idea is to create like expectation, like it's coming down the pike. So if you're thinking about donating, donate, right? It feels a little bit, I understand what you're saying. Like, a lot of people recommend that you line donors up. But like, my perspective is like, I can't be presumptuous that anyone's for sure going to donate. I'm just going to try my best and just hope for the best. I feel weird going to someone and being like, you know, I need you to donate. Will you donate at this time? You know?
No, it's not like, it's not like, hey, I like someone just did this to me recently. And I was on their podcast. They're a listener of our podcast and everything. And, you know, they're like, hey, you know, we're launching on this day. Like, you know, are you able to support us? And if you are you able to be one of our backers for our first day to, like, you know, whatever, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, sure. I'll be down. Like, I'll, you know, log in on that day. Just remind me when to log in and I'll do it. And I'll throw in whatever I can do. That's and I think that nice. Message, I think it's a nice message. And I think it's an okay way to like let someone know about the crowdfunding campaign, and then like to have that like, and it's because it's very non-threatening. It's like, oh, if you can't give, that's okay. A shout out would be great on that day if you can do that, you know. But if you can even support us with $1, that would be amazing, you know. And I think there's like a really nice way to ask without making it feel awkward.
Yeah.
The thing that we did on ours, which I thought was really great, because I was looking for fundraising at the same time that we were planning the crowdfunding campaign. And anytime someone would say no to, like, you know, being a, you know, an actual investor, I would be like, hey, you know, we're doing our crowdfunding campaign. It launches on this day. Like, are you able to, you know, throw in some money to the crowdfunding campaign? And then all, most of the time they'd be like, yeah, sure. I can throw in $1,000 or $500 or whatever.
Oh, God.
I'd be like, whoa, holy shit. Really? You're going to throw me $1,000? God damn. You know? And so like, cause like you're going from asking somebody for like $10,000 to $20,000 or $5,000 or whatever you know, whatever your basic pitch is for, you know, being an investor in the movie. So like when they say no to that, they're like, well, I really like the idea. I really like the project. It's like, oh, $1,000 suddenly becomes easy, or $500 bucks or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that's a really good way to approach it, is like, if you're crowdfunding and you're fundraising at the same time, there's some really beautiful overlap that can happen, you know? And then totally. You know that you got to know that there's going to be some people, you know, who are going to support you. And so if you know who those people are, which I'm sure you probably do, then timing those people is good. Like, even if you don't know what they're going to give, it's like, you know, it can be helpful to be like, yeah, I got like these three or four people who I know are going to support me doing it on day one. And then I know I got like these two or three people who are going to support me, like saved for like, you know, the 50% mark. So like we have a little boost at this time, you know, which is kind of the way I played it with like my friends and family who I'd already knew were going to like, I don't, you know, toss in some money. So that was kind of what I did. And I think it was really good. And I've seen people go to the extreme where they like line up way more than that. You know, they like line up 70% of their goal beforehand. It's like, well, then what's the even point of giving the feed to the crowdfunding?
Open just up your bank money. Account. Yeah, that's really right, weird.
But if you get 30%, you know, that you pre-arrange, and then you have it like, you know, maybe you drop 20 on the first day and then you save 10 for later or whatever. Like, I think that is not necessarily a bad clue, but it's just really interesting that like you are like the queen of crowdfunding and then you don't do that. So like you obviously make it work another way, you know?
Yeah. I think my perspective is like, I don't want to turn it into a transaction. Like, I think of it as like a very emotional experience. So if people give money, it's almost like a surprise party. Like, I don't know who's going to show up, but I'm like, I got the venue. Like, I got the food. This is not going to work with our earlier conversation about me hitting parties, but let's just say I liked parties. It's like, I'm setting it up and then the people who want to show up will show up and they're going to be rewarded with my everlasting love and affection forever, because they're going to be part of making this movie that I've spent 4 years trying to make so far, right? So I'm more just thinking about like looking forward to the surprise of it all. That's how I think of it, more as a mystery.
And do you feel like, are you doing Kickstarter? Is that what you're doing for your platform?
Yeah.
And are you're doing, I guess they only have, Kickstarter is just one, right? It's just where you either get it or you don't. They don't have other
options. It's all or nothing. Options. Yeah.
All or nothing. Yeah. So, and what is your expectation? Like, do you think there's a chance that you wouldn't get it all? And if you were trending that you weren't going to, you know, hit your goal, what would you do in that scenario? Like, how would you play that?
I think we can get to 10. Really, pretty confident about getting to 10. Sean and I can split the remaining 15 if we really have to, right?
Wow.
I don't think we have a lot of money, but in order to get the 10, we're willing to get taxed by Kickstarter on the 15, right?
Wow.
So that's kind of where we're at, is we're willing to gamble a little bit here.
Yeah. That's basically what I did with my first crowdfunding campaign. And it wasn't like planned or anything. It's like, I think I asked for 12,000 or something like that. And I got to like 6 or 650, and then I did the rest myself, yeah. You know, and it was like totally a blunder, because not only did I do that, I also had tons of physical shit that I was offering. Oh. So like I had to do t-shirts and DVDs and all this other stuff. I like made a lot of mistakes on my first crowdfunding campaign that I did not make on the second one.
But you got to make the project. That's the, I mean,
I did.
Yes, you made mistakes, but you made your film too.
I probably could have approached it in a much different way. Like I probably could have waited to do the crowdfunding campaign till later when I had more time. Like I kind of just rushed it all and it was a bad choice.
Well, I mean, in signing off from this segment, just anyone who has a question or comment about crowdfunding, right? Like, they can send it to us, because we both have been through the gauntlet that is crowdfunding multiple times. You could send it to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. We want to shout out the ISA, or the International Screenwriters Association. We wanted to let you know that they offer a ton of programs, including publishing log lines to industry professionals. They have consultation courses, contests, stuff like that. NetworkISA.org. Head on over. Thanks to Rhodes Fire and Ty Gordon for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimut, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you all next week.
Oh my gosh, Elric, you need like five more arms.
Babies here. They took me over.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.